Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And when we make our appeals to heaven, we want to, we want to ensure that we kind of apply those things we've learned so that we can actually articulate more accurately the things that we need help with. So anyway, learn, pray, and act. We also would lay out the strategy. It's all about full compliance to the Constitution. And as we've gone through so many different things, there's lots of states that have state constitutions that were created unconstitutionally because the federal government mandated things in the state constitution they had no authority to do, like creating public lands. The concept of public lands was an unconstitutional concept. And so, right, wrong, or indifferent, almost every state that has that language in their state constitution should be immediately revoked, and any land that they've basically been steward over or dubbed, you know, a a third party or second party steward, then that all goes away. As a matter of fact, one of the things I've found in reading state constitutions is the people never delegated to the state to literally own and control any land within it. I don't see hardly any state constitutions that give the state the authority to have parks or forests or anything like that. So anyway, this is why we've got a little bit of cleaning up to do, and another part of cleanup between now and the 2028 election. If you want to have a constitutional president that's actually going to lead this nation in restoring and reclaiming the republic based on the framers' model, we have to start demanding that the Electoral College be restored to we the people. So, with that, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And are you enjoying these Massachusetts debates?
I'm enjoying reading the parts that we know that.
Okay. Good. So,
you know, that the government doesn't have full authority over every single thing is of our lives, and it just confirms it in the ratification debate.
So. Yes, right. And the Federalist Papers never go there. The Federalist Papers kind of dance around stuff and so forth. And there are a few times where Madison makes comment, but I will tell you, Hamilton, the way he takes his position, without actually being, in other words, Madison says that they can only do those things that are, you know, enumerated in the Constitution. Hamilton doesn't do that. What Hamilton basically says, you know, he points to these things that they could do, and he just kind of scoffs and says, no, he doesn't say that that's unconstitutional. He calls it a red herring. In other words, he doesn't really end the discussion by saying they can't do that. That's not enumerated. They can't touch that. So this is the more I have read and understand about Hamilton and what he's done kind of helps really clarify why he did what he did with the Federalist Papers. But that being said, we're in the middle of a kind of a long dissertation by the Honorable Mr. Bowdoin, and this is on January 23rd, folks. And we're kind of covering that part where he's talking about the oath of office, and then he'll go into delegated powers. But let's go ahead and pick up with, because what he's going to go into next is the guarantee clause that they guarantee to every state in the union a republican form of government. So let's go ahead and pick that up.
Okay. The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government, and shall protect each of them against invasion and domestic violence. To these great checks, Maybe added several other essential ones, as the negative, which each house has upon the acts of the other, the disapproving power of the president, which subjects those acts to a revision by the two houses, and to a final negative, unless two-thirds of each house shall agree to pass the returned acts, notwithstanding the president's objections, the printing the journals of each house, containing their joint and respective proceedings, and the publishing from time to time a regular statement and account of receipts and expenditures of all public money, none of which shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law. All these checks and precautions provided in the Constitution must, in a great measure, prevent an abuse of power, at least in all flagrant instances, even if Congress should consist wholly of men who are guided by no other principle than their own interest. Under the influence of such checks, this would compel them to conduct which, in general, would answer the intention of the Constitution. But the presumption is, and if the people duly attend to the objects of their choice, it would be realized that the President of the United States and the members of Congress would, for the most part, be men not only of ability, but of good moral character, in which case an abuse of power is not to be apprehended, nor any error in the government, but such as every human institution is subject to.
Right. So it's kind of maybe a little legalese, the way he said this. If the people duly attend to the objects of their choice, it would be realized. Now, I don't think most people kind of understand what he's talking about, but it's our responsibility to make sure that the federal government and our state government, our governments, period, function within the objects that we delegate. You know, in other words, we've decided to go ahead and give them these powers. Our delegates that formed the constitutions in our stead, right? Because it's all done by representation. Mm-hmm. We send people to go, you know, create a constitution, go do good things. And so they're doing that in our name. In other words, it is a representation of our suffrage, our voice, what have you. So the point is that it is our responsibility to make sure that what they are doing are those things that we've delegated. We should always step up and say, hey, hold on here. You don't have the power to do that. So anyway, let's go down to where he actually talks about the delegated powers.
With regards to rights, the whole Constitution is a declaration of rights which primarily and principally respect the general government intended to be formed by it, the rights of particular states or private citizens not being the object or subject of the Constitution, they are only incidentally mentioned. In regard to the former, it would require a volume to describe them, as they extend to every subject of legislation not included in the powers vested in Congress, and in regard to the latter, as all governments are founded on the relinquishment of personal rights in a certain degree. There was a clear impropriety in being very particular about them. By such a particularity, the government might be embarrassed and prevented from doing what the private as well as the public and general good of the citizens and states might require. The public good in which private is necessarily involved might be hurt by too particular an enumeration, and the private good could suffer no injury from a deficient enumeration, because Congress could not injure the rights of private citizens without injuring their own, as they must, in their public as well as private character, participate equally with others in the consequence of their own acts. And by this most important circumstance, in connection with the checks above mentioned, the several states at large, and each citizen in particular, will be secured as far as human wisdom can secure them against the abuse of the delegated power.
Okay, so do you kind of garner what he was saying regarding the particular enumeration, that the private, mm-hmm. the public good in which the private is necessarily involved might be hurt? So the public good, for the government to be able to do something, they may actually have a problem being able to do that if the enumeration is too specific. Mm-hmm. In other words,
you know, it has to be a certain color, and all of a sudden you can't get that dye anymore, and you can't make that, you know, let's say they were printing money, and the money had to be printed by a certain color. And if they couldn't get that, then they couldn't print anymore. And the only way they could change that is by an amendment, because it's very specific. That's what they have to do. So, but what he goes on and says, that the private good can never be hurt by these types of enumerations, because that's all they can do. In other words, these things were considered necessary for government to do, so that they could basically protect our interests. And by having these particular specifications or these enumerated objects, they can do this, 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 and this. And by doing that, and by giving them that, it's not like we can be hurt. It's when we give them open charge or basically general powers, then we can be hurt dramatically, because they can use their discretion to do whatever they want to do. So, anyway, Mr. Taylor comes up with a complaint. So let's go ahead and see what he has to say, what his complaint is.
Okay, Dr. Taylor said the consideration of the eighth section had taken up a great deal of time. That gentleman had repeated the same arguments over and over again, and although the order of the convention was that the proposed constitution should be considered by paragraphs, he was pleased, he said, to observe that the honorable gentleman, fast speaking, had gone into the matter at large, and therefore he hoped that other gentlemen would take the same liberty, and that all further observations might be on the system at large.
So you see, you know, hey, let's keep this thing going here, and let's be quick. In other words, I don't know, but we could go to the very end of the Massachusetts debates, because they actually identify who voted and how they voted. And maybe Dr. Taylor would just wanted to, you know, vote against this and be done with it, because usually when I see this type of thing, you know, come on, this is somebody that's predisposed to a decision already.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
Right. I don't care about the debates. I've already made up my mind.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So now Mr. Parsons of Newburyport goes through a couple of points, such as the oath of and religious tests, as well as the act of usurpation, are not obligatory by law. So let's go ahead and start off with the oath, what he covers there. Go ahead.
Okay. The president, is that where we're at?
Nope. No, it's actually down a little bit. You have to, somehow let me see here. You go jumped down to the next page. It says oath.
Okay. I see where we're at. It has been objected that the Constitution provides no religious test by oath. We may have in power unprincipled men, atheists, and pagans. No man can wish more ardently than I do that all our public offices may be filled by men who fear God and hate wickedness. But it must remain with the electors to give the government this security. An oath will not do it. Will an unprincipled man be entangled by an oath? Will an atheist or a pagan dread the vengeance of the Christian's God, a being, in his opinion, the creature of a fancy and credulity? It is a solecism, an expression. No man is so illiberal as to wish the confining places of honor or profit to any one sect of Christians. But what security is it to government that every public office shall swear that he is a Christian? For what will then be called Christianity? One man will declare that the Christian religion is only an illumination of natural religion, and that he is a Christian. Another Christian will assert that all men must be happy hereafter in spite of themselves. A third Christian reverses the image and declares that let a man do all he can, he will certainly be punished in another world. And a fourth will tell us that if a man use any force for the common defense, he violates every principle of Christianity. Sir, the only evidence we have of the sincerity of a man's religion is a good life, and I trust that such evidence will be required of every candidate by every elector. That man who acts as an honest part to his neighbor will most probably conduct honorably towards the public.
Okay, so he
good points.
Go ahead, and he goes on here.
It has been objected that we have not as good security against the abuse of power under the new Constitution as the Confederation gives us. It is my deliberate opinion that we have a better security. Under the Confederation, the whole power, executive and legislative, is vested in one body in which the people have no representation, and where the states, the large and the small states, are equally represented in all the checks the states have is a power to remove and disgrace an unfaithful servant after the mischief is perpetrated. Under this Constitution, an equal representation immediately from the people is introduced, who by their negative and the exclusive right of originating money bills have the power to control the Senate, where the sovereignty of the states is represented. But it has been objected that, in the old Confederation, the states could at any time recall their delegates, and there was a rotation. No essential benefit could be derived to the people from these provisions, but great inconveniences will result from them. It has been observed by a gentleman who has argued against the Constitution that a representative ought to have an intimate acquaintance with the circumstances of his constituents, and after comparing them with the situation of every part of the Union, so conduct as to promote the common good. Hold on.
So the sentiment
mm-hmm. is an excellent one and ought to be engraved on the hearts of every representative. But what is the effect of the power of recalling? Your representative, with an operating revocation over his head, will lose all ideas of the general good and will dwindle to a servile agent, attempting to serve local and partial benefits by cabal and intrigue. Mm-hmm. There are great and insuperable objections to a rotation. It is an abridgment of the rights of the people, and it may deprive them, at critical seasons, of the services of the most important characters in the nation. It deprives a man of honorable ambition, whose highest duty is the applause of his fellow citizens, of an efficient motive to great and patriotic exertions. The people, individually, have no method of testifying their esteem but by a re-election, and shall they be deprived of the honest satisfaction of wreathing for their friend and patriot a crown of laurel more durable than a monarchy can bestow? It has been objected that the Senate are made too dependent upon the state legislature. No business under the Constitution of the Federal Convention could have been more embarrassing than the constructing the Senate, as the body must conduct our foreign negotiations and establish and preserve a system of national politics, a uniform adherence to which can alone induce other nations to negotiate with and confide in us. It is certain the change of men who compose it should not be too frequent and should be gradual. At the same time, suitable checks should be provided to prevent an abuse of power and to continue their dependence upon their constituents. I think the conventions have most happily extricated themselves from the embarrassment. Although the senators are elected for 6 years, yet the Senate as a body composed of the same men can exit only for 2 years without the consent of the states. Okay. If the states think proper, 1/3 of that body may at the end of every second year be new men. When the Senate act as legislators, they are controllable at all times by the representatives, and in their executive capacity in making treaties and conducting the national negotiations. The consent of 2/3 is necessary, who must be united to a man, which is hardly possible, or the new men biennially sent to the Senate, if the states choose it, can control them, and at all times there will also be 1/3 of the Senate, who at the expiration of 2 years must obtain a re-election to return to the mass of the people. And the change of men in the Senate will be so gradual as not to destroy or disturb any national systems of politics.
Okay, so there's one key line he points out that if you kind of, because it's a long sentence, if the states think proper, 1/3 of that body, so about the Senate, at the end of every second year, be new men. When the Senate act as legislators, they are controllable at all times by the representatives, and in their executive capacity, making treaties and conducting the national negotiations, the consent of two-thirds of the Senate is necessary, who must be united to a man, which is hardly possible, or the new men biennially sent to the Senate, if the state chooses it, can control them, and at all times there will be also one-third of the Senate who, at the expiration of two years, must obtain a re-election or return to the mass of the people. In other words, the state had a lot more authority. The only reason that they couldn't understand or they couldn't put into place a direct, you know, like allowing this, instead of having the Senate, allowing the state legislatures to weigh in directly on every issue, is because the technology wasn't feasible. But they're clearly pointing out that the states, if the states choose it, can control them. In other words, they can actually play strong arm and basically say, you will vote these ways. If you vote anything that's contrary, we will remove you. That still applies today. They can remove them for failing to give them their suffrage, because the right of suffrage is still guaranteed in the Constitution. The 17th Amendment didn't change that. Okay, so let's go into the next one.
Okay. It is objected that it is dangerous to allow the Senate a right of proposing alterations or amendments in money bills, that the Senate may by this power increase the supplies and establish profuse salaries, that for these reasons the Lords in the British Parliament have not this power, which is a great security to the liberties of Englishmen. I was much surprised at hearing this objection and the grounds upon which it was supported. The reason why the Lords have not this power is founded on a principle in the English Constitution that the Commons alone represent the whole property of the nation, and as a money bill is a grant to the king, none can make the grant but those who represent the property of the nation. And the negative of the Lords is introduced to check the profusion of the Commons and to guard their own property. The manner of passing a money bill is conclusive evidence of these principles, for after the assent of the Lords, it does not remain with the clerk of the Parliament, but is returned to the Commons, who by their speaker present it to the king as a gift of the Commons.
Okay, so if you stop there, because we're about a minute and a half out from break, and I want to be a little more proactive. So he's kind of pointing out how different the British system was, that the House of Commons kind of controlled, you know, the properties and so forth. But bottom line, we also they pointed out earlier in the Massachusetts debate that the aristocracies, or I should say the people that were in both the House of Commons, the House of Lords and Commons, they were both basically controlled either by corporations or aristocracies. And so England was, you know, literally held and constrained by this concept of the monarch, who kind of lent everything to go their way. Got to remember that Parliament refused to allow the colonies representation. The appeal went to the king, not to Parliament, to actually get our representation into Parliament. And they didn't want that. They wanted to maintain basically control and subjectivity, or making the colonists subjects, not Englishmen. And so that was a huge contention. But he'll go into the money bills on the last part of this, so and kind of clarify. So we'll be right back after this promo. So as we kind of lead into basically, this is a long dissertation. So we've got this long dissertation from Mr. Parsons. And so I kind of want to take a good look at how he's comparing and contrasting the Parliament as well, or in contrast to Congress with the House and the Senate, and how the roles have been completely divvied up. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so he's making these comparisons of why the commons being the kind of where the lands are being controlled. And I have a hard time understanding that, because I understand the aristocracies, but they're usually the large landowners. In other words, the aristocracies are those who kind of control the counties or these large boroughs and these large areas. And the old adage always rings in my mind, he who pays the piper calls the tune, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're complaining about the fact that the Senate, all money bills have to originate in the House. And when we went through the Constitutional Convention, they basically modeled it in the same manner. But the fact is that the Senate has a negative power over any money bill. They can refute it, and actually they can make amendments and so forth, where that's not available in Parliament. And so as they kind of go on, I think he's going to talk more about, you know, the importance of the money bill being in the hands of the people than it is in the Senate. Because clearly the Senate in America is to represent the interest of the state or the interest of the county. It's not about, you know, the taxation being placed upon the people. It's really more about, you know, can we get better trade deals? Can we get, you know, via treaties? Can we, you know, ensure that better policies are being offered? And when you look at the types of policies, today, we have a federal government that creates policies over public lands. They don't have the authority to possess public lands. They shouldn't even be controlling those things. So when we really look at the job of the Senate, the job of the House of Representatives and the federal government, they shouldn't even be in session as long as they are. Because the objects that they actually have to manage and to, is really just national security. Are we going to war? And do we want to tweak our trade deals that we have with, you know, which is what Trump is doing anyway. So anyway, go ahead and pick it back up to where you were.
Every supposed control the Senate by this power may have over money bills, they can have it without it. For by private communications with the representatives, they may as well insist upon the increase of the supplies or salaries as by official communications. But had not the Senate this power, the representatives might take any foreign matter to a money bill and compel the Senate to concur or lose the supplies. This might be done in critical seasons when the Senate might give way to the encroachments of the representatives rather than sustain the odium of embarrassing the affairs of the nation. The balance between the two branches of the legislature would, in this way, be endangered if not destroyed, and the Constitution materially injured. This subject was fully considered by the Convention for forming the Constitution of Massachusetts, and the provision made by that body after mature deliberation is introduced in the federal Constitution. Mm-hmm. It was objected that by giving Congress a power of direct taxation We give them power to destroy the state governments by prohibiting them from raising any monies. But this objection is not founded in the Constitution. Congress have only a concurrent right with each state in laying direct taxes, not an exclusive right. And the right of each state to direct taxation is equally extensive and perfect as the right of Congress. Any law, therefore, of the United States for securing to the Congress more than a concurrent right with each state is usurpation and void.
Let's look at this. Everybody has a problem with taxation, but taxation is only necessary to maintain the spending of government. Does taxation drive, if they can get more money, can they just spend more money on what they want? In other words, if you can go around and start actually, you know, leaning on people, say, give me money, and you get more and more money, and then eventually you go off and buy yourself a house with cash, right? But can they do that? Mm-hmm. Can the government do those things with money? No. They can only spend the money on those things that have been delegated. So why is it that we're really concerned with the fact that they have this power to tax us? They need to be able to function because we've given them the responsibility and power to do these very specific things, and only those things. And so this goes back to that long time talk in that petition that taxation is not the problem. When we have no tie, when there's no connection to the enumerated objects and what they spend money on, then we have a real serious problem because they're actually taxing us unconstitutionally. They're defrauding mm-hmm. the people and basically getting the people to pay for their fraud.
So much fraud.
And so because the people have failed, this goes back up to, you know, that other point where, you know, the responsibility, that due responsibility of the people to hold them to the objects. You know, that's what we need to be doing. We don't need to be, hey, quit taking taxes and complaining about taxation. It's never, the taxation is just what feeds their spending. We have to make sure that they're only spending money on the things authorized. Just imagine when you look at the budget and you actually look at what they legitimately can be spending on defense. It goes down dramatically. I'm just, folks, why is it that we get so caught up on all of the illegitimate things that they do? Let's force them to do the legitimate things. Then they can only spend a stipend. I mean, I don't even think they'd need $1 trillion. Not even $1 trillion to function as, I mean, that would probably mean that we would be at war somewhere. And without the declaration of war, we can't be involved in that. But anyway, okay, so keep going. Thank you.
It has been objected that we have no Bill of Rights. If gentlemen who make this objection would consider what are the supposed inconveniences resulting from the want of a declaration of rights, I think they would soon satisfy themselves that the objection has no weight. Is there a single natural right we enjoy, uncontrolled by our own legislature, that Congress can infringe? Not one. Is there a single political right secured to us by our Constitution against the attempts of our own legislature, which we are deprived of by this Constitution? Not one that I recollect. All the rights Congress can control, we have surrendered to our own legislature, and the only question is whether the people shall take from their own legislatures a certain portion of the several sovereignties and unite them in one head for the more effectual securing of the national prosperity and happiness.
Okay, now the act of usurpation and how it's not obligatory by law. So go ahead.
The honorable gentleman from Boston has stated at large, most of the checks the people have against usurpation and the abuse of power under the proposed Constitution, but from the abundance of his matter, he has, in my opinion, omitted two or three which I shall mention. The oath, the several legislative, executive, and judicial officers of the several states take to support the federal constitution is as effectual as a security against the usurpation of the general government as it is against the encroachment of the state governments. For an increase of the powers by usurpation is as clearly a violation of the federal constitution as a diminution of these powers by private encroachment, and that the oath obliges the officers of the several states as vigorously to oppose the one as the other. But there is another check, founded in the nature of the Union, superior to all the parchment checks that can be invented. If there should be a usurpation, it will not be on the farmer and merchant, employed and attentive only to their several occupations. It will be upon 13 legislators, completely organized, possessed of the confidence of the people, and having the means as well as inclination successfully to oppose it. Under these circumstances, none but madmen would attempt a usurpation. But, sir, the people themselves have in their power effectually to resist usurpation without being driven to an appeal to arms. An act of usurpation is not obligatory, it is not law, and any man may be justified in his resistance. Let him be considered as a criminal by the general government, yet only his own fellow citizens can convict him. They are very innocent. Not all the powers of Congress can hurt him. And innocent, they certainly will pronounce him if the supposed law he resisted was an act of usurpation.
Right. So, more importantly, because he doesn't point this out, but the reality is the federal courts, if it is not something that arises under the Constitution, he's talking about a usurpation. It's something they don't have the authority to do, which what that means is that they don't have the jurisdiction to try you for the crime. Either. Yeah. Right. Okay. So we now go to the next day, and Mr. Davies, or no, this is Mr. Dawes, wants to make some comments regarding guns and standing armies. Are you there?
No, hold on. Oh, okay. I'm there.
All right.
So Mr. Dawes observed upon the authority of Congress to raise and support armies that all the objections which had been made by gentlemen against standing armies were inapplicable to the present question, which was that as there must be an authority somewhere to raise and support armies, whether that authority ought to be in Congress. As Congress are the legislature upon the proposed plan of government, in them only, said he, should be lodged the power under debate. Some gentlemen seem to have confused ideas about standing armies. That the legislature of the country should not have power to raise armies is a doctrine he had never heard before. Charles II in England kept in pay an army of 5,000 men, and James II augmented them to 30,000. This occasioned a great and just alarm through the nation, and accordingly, when William III came to the throne, it was declared unconstitutional to raise or keep a standing army in time of peace without the consent of the legislature. Most of our own state constitutions have borrowed this language from the English Declaration of Rights, but none of them restrain their legislatures from raising and supporting armies. Those who never objected to such an authority in Congress, as vested by the old Confederation, surely ought not to object to such a power in Congress, where there is to be a new branch of representation arising immediately from the people, in which branch alone must originate those very grants that are to maintain an army. When we consider that this branch is to be elected every 2 years, there is great propriety in its being restrained from making any grants in support of the army for a longer space than of their existence. If the election of this popular branch were for 7 years, as in England, the men who would make the first grant might also be second and third for the continuance of the army. And such an acquaintance might exist between the representatives of Congress and the leaders of the army as might be unfavorable to liberty. But the wisdom of the late convention has avoided this difficulty. The army must expire of itself in 2 years after it shall be raised, unless renewed by representatives who at the time will have just come fresh from the body of the people. It will share the same fate as that of the temporary law, which dies at the time mentioned in the act itself unless revived by some future legislature.
Okay, so to be clear, every 2 years is the House of Representatives. So in other words, the House of Representatives have to write the bill to fund that army. Now, actually, to be even more clear, when we really look at this standing army, the reason the king had a standing army was because he had the ability to execute the laws. They didn't create, in England, they did not create a magnificent system that left the militia to the states where they couldn't federalize or create an army. The only permanent military apparatus was the Navy and the Marine Corps. So they were constantly working in the security. The only necessity, the only reason why the federal government would actually deploy an army is because of the execution of laws of the Union, suppressing insurrections, or repelling invasions. They didn't have the authority, really, to maintain security in the territories, but they did it because the people that were moving out into the territories wanted it. They wanted to have the cavalry close by to protect them from harassments of Indians and what have you. And so what ended up happening was the federal government, by basically asserting or exerting that type of military force into the territories, was unconstitutional. They didn't have the authority to do that. That's the whole point. There's no clause in the Constitution to basically say, hey, you know, there are going to be people that are inhabitants living there that you're going to have to police for, you know, those pioneers, those people who are moving into these territories. They didn't have that responsibility. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It should have been on the burden of the people. Period. I mean, the people should have basically said, okay, we have to deal with these things, instead of allowing the federal government, because they've only proven that over time, they have only soured the relationship between, you know, the Indians and the American people. So, I mean, we get what we're given and we get what we deserve in some ways. But anyway, so Captain Dench basically talks a little bit about the exclusive federal town. And so this kind of goes through this long debate of back and forth between these different folks. So let's go ahead and pick this up.
With Dr. Taylor?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Dr. Taylor asked why there was not to be a federal town over which Congress is to exercise exclusive legislation.
Okay, so he's asking, why shouldn't they have a place? To me, because that's what he's asking, ask why there was not to be a federal town. Right? That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So go ahead, Mr. Strong.
Yeah, Mr. Honorable Strong said that every gentleman must think that the erection of a federal town was necessary, wherein Congress might remain protected from insult. A few years ago, said the honorable gentleman, Congress had to remove because they were not protected by the authority of the state in which they were then sitting. He asked whether this convention, though convened for but a short period, did not think it was necessary that they should have power to protect themselves from the insult. Much more so must they think it necessary to provide for Congress, considering they are to be a permanent body. What insult are they speaking of?
Are you asking me a question? I was writing a note.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. When they speak about protecting themselves from insult, what insult are they talking about?
Well, so the state where Continental Congress was sitting, they basically were harassed for, you know, the fact that they were there. In other words, the whole point of the District of Columbia, and actually this is important because Congress, and I should say the federal government, by giving them the seat of government with the District of Columbia, Congress is to have exclusive legislative power only, no one else. So they're supposed to be in full control of that property. When they went and created this act to say, we're creating a new government by creating this governor, because remember when we read the Organic Act and they created that governor for D.C.? They literally abrogated their constitutional responsibility. The only way they could do that constitutionally was to actually have an amendment to say Congress shall have the power to create their own little state and their own little government. But it will never be a state in this union. It cannot be an equal-footed, you know, state to the rest of the states, because the design and concept of the federal government was a subservient role. I mean, they weren't a party in the compact. And the whole point of a state being admitted to the union is that it becomes an equal party to that constitution. And by so doing, it now makes the federal government, now they've kind of backdoored their way into becoming a party to the compact. And they don't have that authority. Mm-hmm. So this is important, because the arguments right here in this ratification debate shuts down the concepts of how unconstitutional these bills, or I should say the amendments to the Constitution, in granting D.C. representation and in granting D.C. electors. You know, you live in D.C., you don't have representation. You live in D.C., you have no say over who's going to be the president. You don't like that? Get out of D.C. It is strictly federal business property. That's it. It's not a place to live. If you want to be close to the breadcrumbs, then that's the cost you have to, I mean, that's the consequences of your decision. Right? That's the cost you have to pay. You can't vote for president. You can't have a representative. And they're trying to make the best of all things, you know, buttering their bread on all six sides by doing what they've done. And to do that, it would literally require, the amendments that they created would require that exclusive legislation go away. And if it's going to be that case, then they should actually remove, and this is what I would do as the states, I would remove that, you know, that seat of government and basically allow them to have needful buildings. And that's it. So they have these buildings, the buildings would sit, and they would become, basically, they would be subjected to the states. The states would be able to harass them once again. This is why this is so important, that the fact that Congress, Continental Congress, had been harassed by its host state and forced them to move somewhere, basically states why there needed to be this autonomy, not their own sovereignty over themselves. No, that was not the point of giving them exclusive legislation. It was only to make sure that states couldn't harass them or what have you, but it was never about making them an equal at all. All right, so the Honorable Mr. Davis of Boston.
Mr. Davis said it was necessary that Congress should have a permanent residence, and that it was the intention of Congress under the Confederation to erect a federal town. He asked, would Massachusetts or any other state wish to give to New York, or the state in which Congress shall sit, the power to influence the proceedings of that body, which was to act for the benefit of the whole, by leaving them liable to the outrage of the citizens of such states? Mm-hmm. And then Mr. Dr. Taylor asked why it need be 10 miles square, and whether 1 mile square would not be sufficient. And the Honorable Mr. Strong said Congress was not to exercise jurisdiction over a district of 10 miles, but one not exceeding 10 miles square.
Right. So, in other words, they didn't say that it had to be 10 miles. They basically said it could not exceed 10 miles square. That makes sense, right?
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Mr. Stillman said that whatever were the limits of the district, it would depend on the session of the legislature of one of the states.
Or two states, because in this case, it was Maryland and Virginia that gave up that little boundary across the Potomac where, you know, they created D.C. between the two states. Okay, so Mr. Dench then
said that he wished further light on the subject, but that from the words, "We the people," in the first clause, ordaining this constitution, he thought it was an actual consolidation of the states, and that if he was not mistaken, the moment it took place, the dissolution of the state governments will also take place.
Okay, now General Brooks stands up and basically says this.
General Brooks rose, he said, to consider the idea suggested by the gentleman last speaking, that this constitution would produce a dissolution of the state governments, or consolidation of the whole, which in his opinion, he said, was ill-founded, or rather, a loose idea. In the first place, he says, Congress, under this constitution, cannot be organized without repeated acts of the legislatures of the several states. And therefore, if the creating power is dissolved, the body to be created cannot exist. In the second place, says the general, it is impossible the general government can exist unless the governments of the several states are forever existing, as the qualifications of the electors of the federal representatives are to be the same as those of the electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures. It was therefore, he said, impossible that the state government should be annihilated by the general government, and it was, he said, strongly implied from that part of the section under debate which gave Congress power to exercise exclusive jurisdiction over the federal town, that they shall have it over no other place.
And there it is. There, right there, they shall have it in no other place. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Keep going.
When
I'm
we
sorry.
Attend yeah. to the Constitution, we shall see, says the general, that the powers to be given to Congress amount only to a consolidation of the strength of the Union, and that private rights are not consolidated. The general mentioned the rights which Congress could not infringe upon, and said that their power to define what was treason was much less than is vested in the legislature of the state by our own constitution, as it was confined in the third section of Article 3rd to levying war or adhering to and comforting enemies only. He mentioned the restraint upon Congress in the punishment of treason and compared it with the extended powers lodged in the Parliament of Great Britain on like crimes, and concluded by observing that as the United States guarantee to each state a republican form of government, the state governments were as effectually secured as though this Constitution should never be in force.
Okay. And now the Honorable Rufus King
said in reply to the inquiry respecting a federal town that there was now no place for Congress to reside in, and that it was necessary that they should have a permanent residence where to establish proper archives in which they may deposit treaties, state papers, deeds of cession, etc.
Okay, so we just ran out of time. I thought we'd actually squeak this last comment from Rufus King in. So we'll pick it up with the Honorable Mr. Rufus King and Mr. Singletary. Folks, it's nothing but gold in these ratification debates because they clarify everything. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.